Hello, kids. Bat Segundo here, and I'm remembering a day when I once had a lawn. It seems so long ago, in the days where I could actually trust people. I'm thinking of a lawn gnome who informed me that his name was Harold. Every Sunday morning, as the sunlight stabbed into my eyes, Harold and I would sit down for a chat. He was a sympathetic figure. He didn't move, and he was more of a silent type than I had hoped. But he certainly saved me a good deal of money in therapy, and because of his palliative value, I was able to write his purchase off on my tax return for that year. Perhaps it was the mescaline, perhaps it was my general state of mind. Nevertheless, Harold was of great comfort to me during a particularly dark period of my life. Near the end of what was once a promising career. I've no idea what happened to Harold the Lawn Gnome. When the repo men came to collect my possessions, Harold was the first to go. He was grabbed in their evil clutches, but he holds a dear place in my heart, and I'm grateful that our young roving correspondent talked with an author who understands the value of lawn gnomes as much as I do.
Okay, so I am here with Nick Mavatas, the author most recently of Under My Roof, as well as Northern Gothic and Move Underground. Nick, how are you doing?
I'm okay.
Okay. Now, I've read three of your books here, your novels, and the common starting point seems to be sort of an X plus Y equals something. In Northern Gothic, you have the Civil War draft rights and racism meeting a gay contemporary life setting. In New York, you have in Move Underground, Kerouac meets Lovecraft, and in Under My Roof, you have sort of suburban satire with telekinesis and nuclear crisis as well. I'm wondering, do you need this kind of merging, two kind of confluence points for your books?
Well, that's not really X plus Y.
Okay.
I have to say, like, in Northern Gothic, for example, it's history.
Yes.
You know, Chelsea today versus Chelsea in the 1860s.
Yes.
Lovecraft and Kerouac, actually, I thought, in my mind, have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. Both New Englanders, both... have cults of readers, even their correspondence has been widely published. Both, you know, influenced tons of horrible pastiches. Both were right-wing cranks. So there's a commonality that's, or a correspondence that wasn't previously disclosed. So I'm not really combining them, but sort of shining a light on, showing where the actual confluence already exists. And with, you know, Under My Roof, Long Island, where the setting is, you know, was the home of Grumman for years and Fairchild, all these incredible defense contractors. And the wealth of Long Island is really built on nuclear weapons, you know.
Gotcha. So for you, it's just a matter of kind of exploring existence confluence.
That's right.
Okay.
Going a little deeper. From the appearance to the essence. How about calling it that? That's a...
I noticed, I know that for Under My Roof's, in Under My Roof's case, it's actually based on Aristophanes' The Acharnians. And
yes.
I'm wondering what compelled you to start from a classical source. Did you see comparisons between the Peloponnesian War and Iraq, or...?
Well, I just happened to read Iraq during the first Gulf War. I was in college, and I had a playwriting professor who said, read everything. Start with Aeschylus and Mazzola. And around the time I got up to Aristophanes, because I just paid attention to my professor, this first Gulf War had hit. And, you know, this was a... Even 2,500 years later, there's always that impulse to ask, why is this happening? Why is everybody suddenly going crazy with hatred for people who they don't even know?
And yet there isn't another soft skull writer who appears like Euripides in in the play. So
no, but the mother has a self-published book.
Oh, okay.
So there's that. There's that confluence.
Ah, I see. So how much of Aristophanes did you sort of take for this? I mean, was it a sort of loose structure, or where did you feel the need to sort of jump off from or sort of deviate from the plot?
Well, it's not considered one of his better plays.
Yeah.
It's because there's almost no plot to it. The guy makes a separate piece, and you know, the army shows up to complain, and then nothing happens. So that's why he actually lost that year. They have the annual drama competitions or comedy competitions, and I think that came in third, if I remember correctly. So so I had to add a plot.
Okay.
And basically the kid... and having that the conflict between the parents is the plot.
Well, there was no telekinesis really in the play, you know.
Well, yeah, well, telepathy. Telekinesis
telepathy
is moving things.
Yeah.
Telepathy is mind reading.
I'm sorry, telepathy.
But you had the Greek chorus, which was the voice of society. And now with Herbie being a telepath, he can tell you what society is thinking.
Now, you have a nuclear device placed in a garden gnome. I'm wondering why you chose a garden gnome over, say, like a lawnmower or...
Well, at first it was going to be a lawn jockey.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
And the early draft had it as a lawn jockey, but I figured that was too unctuously petty bourgeois. I thought garden gnome was more down market. And also they're bigger, so you can put more nuclear stuff inside a garden gnome.
But at the same time, there's also a certain kind of suspension of disbelief on the part of the reader, because if you actually go ahead and actually try to produce a nuclear device in a garden gnome, there's going to be some radioactive fallout. Yes. The FBI guys kind of show up, and like, I'm thinking the FBI would immediately sort of seize this family, and yet they don't. I was wondering if this kind of realism isn't of a concern for you, or is it meant to be more of a sort of meditative kind of...
Well, partially it's meditative, partially people get away with things. You know, 9/11, people got away with it, even though there were many people watching these terrorists and keeping their eye on them, but they all managed to get through and, you know, carry out this attack. So, I mean, there's almost a nationalist type of myth that the FBI and the CIA are super competent and that we always know what's going on. That's part of why we have the sort of 9/11 denial movement or a conspiracy movement. Ultimately, people are saying, well, nobody could possibly do that thing to us, to us Americans. It has to be us, because we're the all-powerful beings, you know, the all-powerful state. So I think there is room for nuclear things to slip through the cracks.
Now, there's certain sort of subtextual sort of things I noticed in this. There's, of course, the kind of the squabble with the kid, where it's sort of a, like, Elian Gonzalez, and you also have him staying with his mother being homeschooled in Colorado, which suggested to me sort of a Littleton kind of reference, perhaps. I was wondering if these were sort of things that you were kind of consciously designing in the narrative, or...
Well, that's a pretty good, interesting question. I don't think Littleton was part of it, but things do tend to end up in Colorado. Like, in Move Underground, there's a big scene in Colorado, too. So I might have just been unconsciously replicating that. Also, I know some people who left Long Island years ago to move to Colorado because they wanted to be happy there. There was a sort of an exodus when taxes got very high in the early 90s, and a lot of people wanted to move out west.
I guess what I'm sort of asking you is, like, how much of this novel is sort of intended to be this kind of allegorical meditation, and how much of it is sort of like, oh, well, in this case, your friends happen to move to Colorado.
Well, I don't think any of it's supposed to be allegorical. It's applicable, which is different. I think Tolkien even made this about Lord of the Rings years ago. He said, well, it's not an allegory for World War I or for World War II, but it is applicable because human nature is, pretty constant, at least across, you know, broad strokes. You know, the Industrial Age or the Information Age will have a, you know, pretty consistent human nature. So while we can see these correspondences all the time, they're not something I designed. You know, if you end up writing a book where that's just a pure allegory, once that historical moment has passed, the book is useless. You're putting an expiration date on a book.
If it's not allegory, then what is it exactly when you actually sort of draw or are influenced by current events? What purpose is sort of historical events or sort of things? How do they affect you as a writer?
Well, I mean, that's almost such an odd question, you know, sort of saying, you know, how do you feel about being a writer in society? Well, where else can I go? You know, there's no non-society, there's no abstract writing that happens outside of society.
Well, let me rephrase the question. To what degree do historical events concern you in your nonfiction?
See, that's a much better question. I think that's actually a different question than rephrasing, but definitely something I'm very interested in. You know, I'm very interested in politics and in history and in radical politics. So, of course, those are my interests. That's what I see, you know, in when I read the newspapers. That's how I interpret things like elections. So, of course, they're going to show up in my fiction. Just like anything else, if you were very interested in interpersonal psychology, you'll write a lot of bourgeois realism. You know, if you're very interested in romantic escapism, you'll write big fat fantasy novels or romances with lusty pirates. It just happens to be what I'm interested in. I'm not trying to recruit anybody for anything, because, you know, a 40,000 word novel for kids is probably the least effective way of recruiting anyone to a political program ever. But of course, it just naturally comes up as just part of my interest.
Gotcha. Well, speaking of your interests, like, I know Cthulhu, obviously, in the second book is a very big influence. But I also know that you've authored a volume of poetry. I'm wondering, how is Cthulhu the muse here?
Well, the poetry was just sort of a gag. It started out, the book Move Underground came out in two editions, a hardcover edition and a limited edition of 100 copies. And just to make it a little bit more viable, a little bit more collectible, I wrote 100 poems. So the 100 scenario, you know, a comical light verse to... So each one would be in a unique object. And people started trading the verses. Like, oh, I got this one. I got number 56. I got number 17. So then it was pretty cheap to make the 100 of them put into a little chapbook.
Are these sort of limited editions what it takes to sort of be a writer who basically straddles along various independent presses? You have to kind of have gimmicks like this?
Yes, definitely. And at least with hardcover, certainly there are plenty of collectors out there who collect small presses. And My limited edition for Move Underground, I don't even have a copy of it, actually, because they sold it long before publication. But the afterword was me complaining about limited editions, how people just buy them without reading them. And, of course, there were no complaints because nobody read the afterword in the limited edition.
I read the afterword in this, and basically you indicated that this it had taken you 3 years to write 40,000 words. Yes. Well, what was the cause of this sort of slow?
Well, I moved across the country twice. That was I moved here to California, then I moved to Vermont, and that was that took some time. I wrote a lot of short stories in that time. I had bought a house and had rented it out, and the woman I had to get her out of the house. I didn't quite evict her, but she stopped paying rent, so I had to ask her to leave. And within 3 days, the place was stripped of its copper piping and its boiler. So that made it impossible to live in, or to rent out, or to sell.
But wait a minute, you're a socialist here.
Well, I'm socialist under capitalism.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether I'm renting or owning, I'm still a victim of the system. You know, whether you're a peasant or a reaver, you're still under the king. You know.
Yeah.
Well, so I had lots of distractions, and I guess the one big element was trying to find the plot, like trying to do that Aristophanes play point by point was not working. So I sort of had to meditate a little bit and contemplate the plot.
Okay. And all three of these books are actually sort of shorter than other authors. And I'm wondering why these books are sort of shorter. Do you feel that you don't necessarily have a kind of huge, voluminous, David Foster Wallace-like book in you? Or?
Well, partially I hate subplots. I think subplots are very tedious. I think, and there, again, you know, plenty of the classic novels are 45,000 words, 50,000 words, 60,000 words. All of paperback fiction in the 40s and 50s was based on the 50,000-word novel. Only when word processing came out did that turn everyone into a Tolstoy, you know. Yeah. Previously, a 1,000-page book was War and Peace. Now it's anything Stephen King does, you know, between naps.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not so much that I'm too short. I think most books are actually too long. They're about 40,000 words of creative writing and about 60,000 words of nothing. That was actually a problem when we tried to sell Move Underground to the mainstream. The hardcover came out, very popular, good reviews, crossover reviews. It was in The Believer, The Village Voice, Fangoria. Not too many books are reviewed in Fangoria and The Believer. So we had some interest, but then we had people from these big companies, you know, various German overlords and Australian zillionaires and technocrats, the big five companies, would say things like, well, it's too short. This should really be 80,000 words. And I'd say something like, well, what do you want me to add? And they would say, oh, anything. Because they want 80,000-word or 100,000-word novels, not because the readers demand them or because it makes for better books, but because you can put so many on a stack in a spinner rack, or because if you buy so many pounds of paper, you get a price break.
Yeah.
So it's entirely production-based. It's sort of like the big three automakers in the 50s and 60s, before the compact cars really took the wind out of their sails. They make these cars huge because, you know, if you bought this much steel, it would be cheaper. So that's why you have all these, you know, really Baroque-looking cars in the 60s and 50s.
So for you, it's kind of even more of a struggle because you're actually almost doing a sort of novella length.
Yes.
Or somewhere between novella and sort of short
novel.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's a very tough sell. How do you really negotiate that? I mean, when did, for example, Jeremy Lassen and Richard Nash enter into the equation during these various...
Richard Nash, before Under My Roof, we had tried to sell this to a big publisher again, and we get things like, this is a really great book, great proposal, but we don't like the nuclear bomb. Can't the kid have a girlfriend? Like Napoleon Dynamite instead of a nuclear bomb. And I had worked with Soskal years ago under this previous management, which was an exciting, exciting in quotes, time. And I just happened to send 4,000 words of it to Richard. Mm-hmm. And a few months later he said, oh, why don't you finish it and then maybe I'll buy it. I said, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. You know that I can write books, so why don't you buy it and then I'll finish it. And there was about 18 months of struggle over that. And I finished half of it, then he bought it. And that's how it went out with Nightshade and Move Underground. That manuscript had been passed around a lot as well, with people saying it's great, you know, oh, it reminds me of Tim Robbins, this is probably the best books I've ever read. That's not for us. You know, people like Rock and Ace and St. Martin's were saying things like, well, this is a really wonderful book. I passed it around the office, we made copies of it, we're not going to sell this, you know. As it turned out, a friend of mine who ran another small press called Prime Books, and I showed him a copy of it, and he didn't want to pay in advance because he was very small, and he said, well, you can't send it to Nightshade because they're all booked up. So he sent it to Jeff Vandermeer at Ministry of Whimsy without me knowing. So I got a rejection letter from Jeff Vandermeer without even having submitted the work to him. And he gave it to Nightshade. And then some months later, I heard from Nightshade that they really enjoyed the book and wanted to do it. So I actually ended up publishing with a company I'd never even submitted to.
Now,
which is very common.
Turning to Under My Roof, I actually wanted to ask, what is the origin of, for example, the Q Bars and Cool Mart? Where did these things come from?
Like, those sort are of my hometown of Port Jefferson in Long Island. Yeah,
they actually do exist.
Well, they have a Cool Mart with a K, and I just made it a Q. And,
okay.
The Q Bar is actually the old Sky Bar. I don't know if you have them out here in California.
I'm familiar with the Sky Bars.
And when I was a kid, I loved Sky Bars. And just a few years ago, when I was sitting down to write the book, I found a Sky Bar for the first time in years, and I was really excited. It brought me back to my childhood. And I bought it, and it was horrible. It's, you know, very waxy chocolate, really a degenerated peanut butter. But I figured, you know, I was so enthused about this branding, even though, you know, I'm supposed to be this radical guy, just the yellow and white stripes, you know, just triggered so many emotions in me that I had to put it into the book somehow.
Well, there actually is quite a lot of, I guess, so-called product placement in this book, yes. Which I found quite interesting. You have iPods, you have Angel Fire, there's we can go continue
to live journal,
laundry
yes.
list, live journal. Yet it's set sort of in the distant future, and I'm wondering if this sort of, you know, posed a problem with you. Why did you use kind of contemporary sort of products?
Well, it's 2011.
Okay.
So not that far in the future. I should have probably put it in MySpace instead of live journal or something like that, but what you gonna do?
Yeah. In terms of, like, did you do any sort of, you know, invention of, like, future products or, you know, current trends? What was the sort of criteria for putting something like LiveJournal in there?
Whether I knew about it, whether I was involved, and I have a LiveJournal that's pretty popular, so I figured, oh, and whenever anything would happen, you know, Gerald Ford drops dead or, you know, a guy says somebody else on the subway, everybody reports it like they're reporters.
Well, I read in this, like, for example, like, them constructing meth from cough syrup, and now there's these limitations that kicked in.
I know that.
I got sick earlier this year. Exactly. Well, what can you do, really?
And another thing that happened, I had them at the beginning of the book show the 9/11 footage over and over again on Patriot Day, and that's actually what happened on CNN.com this past November, September 11th.
Yeah.
They ran it. So I guess it's sort of a prediction, even though I was predicting this in 2003. That comes true. But, I mean, that's also that's a problem with any science fiction. I've been reading The Space Merchants recently, and it's from the 50s. It's about advertising. And, you know, in some ways it has this great degenerated future, semi-dystopian, with advertising taking over. They have things like, you know, oh, I had to go through my morning mail. Everybody's smoking in the office. You know, so on some level you have these great predictions coming true. On another level you have people still acting like it's 1953, even though it's supposed to be, you know, 2087 in that book. So it's just a cost of doing business. It's just a
the reader has to kind of
inevitable
accept this.
Problem,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about fantasy and science fiction and mm-hmm. horror and postmodernism too. I know you're
four things I'm against.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, anyway, your work falls somewhere within those kinds of things. There are elements mm-hmm. of all of those in your work, and yet you're also, I know, you're pursuing an MFA. Now, MFA workshops aren't exactly sort of postmodern or fantasy-friendly sometimes.
Well, I picked the MFA that was going to be friendlier.
Oh, okay.
I picked Western Connecticut State University because, for no other reason than I saw an ad for it, and David Hartwell of Tor Books was on the board. So I have no interaction with David Hartwell. I don't know him. Only by reputation, and I didn't know anybody in the program, but I had a feeling that they wouldn't fly into a genre panic. Also, my MFA is in professional writing, not creative writing, so there's more of an emphasis on the commercial. This is why my classmates are writing mysteries and little noir pieces and you know, business communications and these sort of horrible self-help type of books.
Do you find that your writing is shifting because of the MFA? Or?
No, not at all.
Okay.
It's actually been a really... I don't want to say an uneven experience, but that's sort of being too fair to it. It's been a horrible experience, actually, because I've been a writer for 10 years. I've published in the Village Voice, published pretty widely, and I'm just getting an MFA because I want to teach one day because I want health insurance. I mean, I don't even want to teach. I just want health insurance. I will teach for health insurance, I should say.
Live in California and Massachusetts.
That's right.
What it looks like. You'll have to pay regardless.
Exactly.
So
as far as an MFA goes, I mean, every sort of mistake that you can possibly think of, you know, every little cliche...
Yeah.
That you hear about from friends who have MFAs or you read about on blogs about MFAs. That's true, but I didn't realize how common they were. I thought this was like sort of the individual anecdote, the one bad experience we'll have. I didn't realize these were daily occurrences.
Yeah. No, there's actually this, suddenly, like this confessional streak. People are finally revealing just how the inside the MFA experience, you know.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, actually, and this is a very common question sure. I intended to ask earlier, but you also write a lot of short stories, and I was mm-hmm. wondering, what is the difference between something that becomes sort of a novel and a short story to you? When do you know that it's sort of an idea that you can stretch out into this?
Oh, the moment I get the idea. It's fairly obvious. I don't think, oh, is this idea a short story idea or a novella idea or a novel idea? I mean, I've only had a couple novel ideas. Because I'm only interested in novels as a form, because you know, it's full of subplots and this padding. The modern novel, or the postmodern novel, whatever you want to call it, really is it's sort of like watching a Bollywood film.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be musicals, there has to be an intermission, there has to be 4.5 hours long, because people won't accept it otherwise. I mean, the production people won't accept it otherwise. So I have very few ideas for Bollywood musicals.
Yeah. Well, going back to this question also, which we raised earlier about ideology or sort of your experience kind of nestled within the work, there's the remark that about religion, you know, basically, you know, religious experience are just a weird thing that happens to people's brains.
Yes.
That this is being said by someone who's telepathic is a rather extraordinary experience. So what kind of causes you to sort of dip into ideology like this in your work?
Well, I mean, I think there's ideology in every work you can possibly read. It generally tends to be the dominant ideology, so it blends in. It's sort of like being a fish in water.
Yeah.
They don't realize they're in water. As far as the crack about religion, it just came based on one weird comment that actually is also in the book that I had with an acquaintance of mine, Madonna had something done something dumb with the Kabbalah, and he said, you know, that's so bad because I think everyone's going to think all Christians act that way. I just said, what the hell are you talking about? One, Kabbalah's a Jewish thing, you know. I said, well, people don't know that. I'm like, what are you talking about? This guy's from Canada, so maybe there's not a huge Jewish population in his part of Western Canada. But, you know, being from New York, of course, you know, and I think everyone knows between Jews and Christians, this guy just wasn't that sharp. And it was just such a weird comment people make. And it's just something so common. Oh, people think all Christians act that way. But when you say that often, maybe all Christians act that way, you know. So I wanted to make a comment about religion just because it's just such an integral part of the American experience. Just this past week, I was reading in the paper, the AP had, and I think the question might have been phrased a little awkwardly. The poll claimed that 25% of people are waiting for Christ to come back in a sort of a rapture type experience within the next 12 months. Now, they may have been asked whether they're hoping for this or not expecting it, but that's a very high number.
Yeah.
You know.
They probably have some Outlook reminder. Christ to return. I wanted to actually ask you about the character testimonials that are at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
They reminded me very much of the work of like Lance Olson and Kathy Acker.
Yes.
And they're a total departure from you based on the three books of yours I've mm-hmm. read. And I'm wondering how this came to be. And in its own way, it's also sort of like the end of American Graffiti or something.
Exactly, the end of Animal House.
Yeah,
where are they now?
Yeah.
And that was definitely part of it. And I love Lance Olson, love Kathy Acker.
Yeah.
But I wanted to just blow up the place a little bit, blow up the story, because it was very much about... the kid Herbie and his experience and how the nation state and how learning the nation state is like a bullshit lie, like Americanism doesn't mean anything or patriotism doesn't mean anything. It's pretty much the same experience you have as you have when you're a kid and you realize your parents are not infallible or they're not perfect or when they can be petty small people. So I wanted to have that reflected by not just by Herbie, who's, you know, this telepathic genius, but by having other people through the experience figure that out and talk about it from different points of view. And since I've already have things like, you know, the fun facts about Weinbergia, the small country in there, and Herbie's term papers, and the elements from the self-published book by the mother, I didn't feel like I was like that was an exceptional breaking of the traditional first-person narrative.
But you just needed to kind of have a coda here.
Yeah, basically. Exactly.
Okay. I was wondering if you were familiar with George Saunders' book from 2005, The Brief Frightening Reign of Phil, which is also about a microstate.
Yes.
Did you feel sort of fear when that book came out, like, oh my God, Saunders has done it?
And yes.
Yeah,
and I have not read the book because of that.
Okay.
I was still in the midst of finishing this, and I didn't read it then. But then I figured, you know, how many books are there about lusty pirates falling in love with, you know, some maiden they see on a beach? Well, thousands. So we can have two about microstates. I like Saunders' stuff. He was actually asked to blurb this book, but we asked him. Unfortunately, the day after he became a genius from the Genius Grant, so then he became really busy and he couldn't blurb anything anymore because everybody on Earth asked him to blurb it.
Was Duck Soup an inspiration? You know, since it's the size of a country of a postage stamp. Or?
Yep, Duck Soup, The Mouse That Roared. I mean, there's a long tradition of tiny countries. The episode of Family Guy where Peter declares his Peteria when they see that he's not on the map. There's a small tradition, but a significant one, because we live in countries all the time, but we never really conceive of them as countries, unless you travel very widely or an immigrant's child as I am, you know.
This book has more of a sort of satirical element to it than your two other books, although there are elements of satire in those, clearly, obviously, and having Kerouac come up against Cthulhu. Yeah. But I wanted to ask you, why did you feel that the time was right to kind of come up with a more sort of satirical offering?
Well, partially it's because of Harry Potter, actually.
Oh, really?
And the huge explosion of young adult fantastical fiction.
Yeah.
And now many people are leaving adult fantastical fiction where they're not making a lot of money to write YA books. And there are plenty of YA books that are crossing over into adult fiction. You see, again, partially because of Potter. So I wanted to have my own version of this.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't really being published as a YA book. Although we have a quote from Zoe Trope. It's going to go to the school library journal, and we're trying to get some schools to buy it. And just, you know, kids are impressionable.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have a podcast and a blog. Obviously, a book for you was probably, when you were young, a life-changing experience. So I wanted to have this sort of life-changing experience for kids. Well, for me, it was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where you had... And the theme of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy's books are that the universe is vast and infinite, and you're microscopic and useless and futile, but don't worry about it. And that can be, you know, that can really shake you up. It really puts things in perspective for you when you're 8 years old.
Do you think this is really sort of the future? Because, I mean, China Mieville also has a
YA
book.
Yeah, coming out. It's the near future. I mean, I think it'll fade away as these things do. Mm-hmm. In 5 years or so.
Okay.
Like horror in the 80s, for example. You had horror was a huge explosion in the 70s and 80s. And then people who were even skipping genres, like Sherry Tepper, the feminist science fiction author, was writing horror novels. Tom Dish, the... once radical, now cranky right-winger science fiction author, was writing the review column for Twilight Zone magazine and writing these horror novels. But of course, they didn't love horror. They're not into horror. They were looking for the cheap payday, and we'll see the same thing happen here. And then after the market collapses, as markets must collapse, they'll stop.
But at the same time, YA is a very good format for you because
it's short.
Exactly. You slip right in there. Yes. I mean, would you say the other two books are YA-like in any way, or, you know...
I don't think Northern Gothic. I think Northern Gothic has a little bit too much transgressive sex for YA.
Yeah.
But oddly enough, I have found this blog of this young girl, 14 years old, and she has all these quotes from her favorite books, and half of them are from Mover Underground. I have no idea how she got this book, how it would even come across her. When I was 14, I have no idea where the small press even existed.
Yeah.
But somehow she got her hands on it, and she loved the book. And, you know, it's me and a bunch of anime characters floating around her website.
Mm-hmm.
So sure, why not? I mean, for a small number of YA people, for a small number of kids who read and read a lot and read deeply, it's sort of like, you know, it's waving the freak flag for them. It's something they can say, you know, oh, there's somebody out there who thinks kind of like I do. Or who's he telling me I don't have to think like everyone else does? And I think that's a fine role for YA fiction.
When did you know that this book was actually going to be a YA book? Did you know midway through? Did you know at the beginning? Did you start off with YA? Did someone encourage you and say, hey, Nick, you are a YA guy?
It was my mother and my then-girlfriend. My mother said, could you please stop writing books with all this cursing in it? And my then-girlfriend said, you know, you should write a book for kids. And I have no idea why she even said that. I'm actually staying with her now in SF. I should ask her when I go home, because I forget the context of the conversation. But it was, you know, you always write these, you know, weird, dark, depressing, annoying things. Why don't you write something for kids? And I said, that's dark and depressing and annoying. She's like, oh, whatever, as long as it's for kids. So I started this. And I had, you know, the young protagonist. And my agent and I had a conversation about, you know, how old do you make a protagonist so people will read it? 12 is sort of the perfect age. Adults will read a 12-year-old. 12-year-olds will read a 12-year-old. People younger than 12 will read a 12-year-old. But if you made them like 15, then you lose the younger kids, but you don't really gain too many of the older kids because they want to read about people going to college and such. So 12 was a good age. And that worked out really well.
I wonder if any of this sort of dictated the CIA fact book facts, because it seems like that could almost be put into some sort of children's book. You know?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the CIA fact book is...
A children's book.
A children's book. I mean, here you go, George W. This is something you can understand, you know.
DJs.
Number one export of Jamaica's bananas somehow.
Yeah. Nick, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Say ho!
What was he up?
Now somebody, anybody, everybody.